Any takers?
Students, going once, going twice.
Professors.
Well, it is a question, I guess. In the hermeneutics of the subject, Foucault seems to interrogate the question, how can the subject have access to truth, right? Can he have it just as he is? And he seems to argue that Descartes, right, with the Cartesian moment, Descartes says, the subject has access to truth just as he is. Now, that's obviously, people have critiqued him for saying that, but he goes further to say so. Kant, in the Critique of Pure Reason, would say, yes, the subject has access to truth just as he is. But then, in the Critique of Practical Reason, it's no. Could you speak to what happens, the difference in those two works, that would make
you
that
don't
answer?
Pay me enough. No, I'm not pretending to be a philosopher. And I'm not actually sure I agree with the Critique of Pure Reason.
Okay.
Because this is a very complex and contested terrain. It contains the status of the categories, space and time. And it seems to me that Kant is playing both of these things. Is it immanent or is it transcendent? And there's a long history that comes before Kant himself, and there's a long history of interpretation afterwards, and it goes to the very status of what one thinks space and time is, and that's a story I would tell as a simple history of ideas coming from Galileo to Newton. I can do that. But I can't do the Kant thing. What's at stake in your question, however, is precisely the degree to which the categories are going to be simply transcendental. That is to say, they act as a category, in which case you're still subject to theology. Because what guarantees the categories are effectively something beyond human capacity, ahistorical. As soon as you bring it into the political, then, of course, you are into the question of who actually authorizes, if not some transcendental sovereign. And, of course, Kant's answer is man is sovereign. And the question there, Foucault's reading of this, of Kant, is, and it's my reading too, is that Kant is actually working through an immanent account of the knowing subject. And it's a risk. I use that word intentionally. You can never have the final guarantee that those categories are actually universal. So I would actually push the more interesting reading of Kant not to the transcendental side of it, but precisely to the immanent side of it. Because that is the position that sets up a possibility of freedom precisely as not relying upon God. And that strikes me as much more consistent with Kant's Lutheranism, actually. It's going to be an immanent politics, a this-worldly working of the universal history through the subject and not coming through some external source. Okay, and therefore, actually, against many people who insist that the later critiques are more interesting politically, I think the first critique is the more interesting politically.
Stephanie, I don't know where to start. let's hypothetically say that it's not the first critique that's most important, but it's the third one. Right, but because the third one is where Kant gets the problem of how do you bring two of them together, right? And it's the third one that as if this risk that you say is this where the transcendental ceases to become purely foundational, becomes purely pragmatic and under scarecrow, right?
Subject.
Yeah, it's judgment that becomes a problem for Kant, right? Now, at the end of the third critique, you get a theory of morality and freedom again. And at the end of Foucault, and this is a hasty relationship, but there's something very interesting about Foucault, is that in the ethics, right, in his talk of thinking of the self, now in the earlier works, you get this distinction between connaissance and savoir, this know that and know how, right? And this is extremely Kantian, right? There's connaissance is the Kantian sort of categorical framework that we envision experience with. And then you have the know-how, which is how we go about in the world with using these categories. But in the ethics, you cease to have this savoir category, right? Because in a sense, you can't know how sacrifice. My thought is wobbling. Truth is a presupposition of genealogy, right? You've said this. In order to have a genealogy, you need truth. You need to presuppose truth beforehand, as opposed to the archaeology that permits truth to emerge, right? Now, in Foucault, the ethical turn, I'm trying to cope with this because there's a relationship between Kant and Foucault ethically, right, in how to act in the world. And that relationship is stoic, right, because Kant is absolutely a stoic. Absolutely. Humanity for Kant is capital H humanity. It's the same thing as Seneca, right?
I mean, absolutely.
In effect, the very idea of stoic ethics is the categorical imperative. We all have to act the same way in the world so we can, and Foucault picks this up at the end of his life, right? If we're all truth tellers, if we're all parisiists, then we're risking at the same level, right? We don't have to fear what other people think of us because it's, we're all taking care of ourselves. There's constant reciprocity and all that jazz. But then you have this idea, and I want to get to this idea of becoming. In Kant, you don't get becoming, right? Because in Kant, everything is presupposed from the get-go, right? You cannot become otherwise than the transcendental ego, right? Your subject is delimited in Kant. It's total, right? You can't move
this beyond. Is a very esoteric debate. It's very esoteric. But I think I disagree with you about the Kantian. The possibility of becoming is present in Kant in a way which some people, some companies refer to it as the originary. It's the switch from the transcendental category to the originary category.
Yeah, but you become what you're supposed to be.
Of course, yes.
Yeah, but in Foucault, you don't become what you're supposed to be.
Precisely, you try to defeat that teleology.
Yeah, but you're constrained in it.
Yes, one always gets caught.
Here's a question. Okay. What's the relationship? What's the relationship? What's the relationship between tragedy, right, ethics, and connaissance? Because there is this Nietzschean... No, there's a Nietzschean side to Foucault, right? I mean... Look, you read Discipline and Punish. Throughout history, we do these actions, we impose these policies, we create these institutions, given the categories that we have. We recreate them. History has such a way of working, power has such a way of working, that people get excluded, right? Even if it's the best intentions possible, right? This is what happens. Foucault realizes this, and at the end, you're stuck. You're stuck because you're always going to be negative, you're always going to act negatively. So this very idea that you're becoming what you're supposed to be in Foucault obliterates itself, right? It's not there because Foucault says, look, whatever way you want, whatever way you act in the world, this souci de soi, this idea that, you know, you can do good or whatnot is, you have to turn back to your autonomous little subject, you have to take care of yourself, you have to do what you think is right, because at the end, 200 years from now, your actions, which you think are the best intentionally possible, are always going to have negative consequences. So tragedy is imminent in the very idea of an ethical practice. I mean, what does he tell us?
Are you saying there's nothing more in Foucault than there is in Nietzsche or Weber?
Weber's different. Weber has hope, Foucault doesn't.
See, I've put it the other way around. Foucault has hope. Nietzsche is an absolute, I mean, Weber's a complete dead end. Because the contradictions come together.
It depends how you read the Iron Cage, right?
Mm-hmm. Foucault is precisely.
I don't think Weber's a teleologist. I don't think Weber's a teleologist.
Let me just say this. I would read one of the ways of situating Foucault as an important thinker, I would say, is to take up many of the same questions that Weber puts together in a totalizing theory of the modern subject and a totalizing theory of the power state, and refuses many of those tight contradictions. And instead of reading them negatively, he opens up in a plural way. So that may be a wrong way of reading either figure, but I personally get some kind of positive charge out of taking Foucault as offering some ground for a critique of the most depressing figure to hit the 20th century, who is Max Weber. It seems to me that unless you can deal with Max Weber and his offshoots, then one has got nothing to say about contemporary politics, actually. And therefore, I take Foucault to be somewhat interesting in this respect. We may disagree on this.
Anyone else?
Well, I'd love to hear a positive explanation of the iron cage.
Well, I think that the iron cage. Look.
Let's give some power. The iron cage. No.
I don't have one. No. You said. You said it's possible.
I don't think it's a. Look. There's been a positive. You used a good word about how Foucault domestication, basically. And it's been grounded in this, you know, that Weber's sociological theory is universalizable, and I don't think it is. And I think that in his politics as vocation, you get this idea that freedom is simply it's a very stoic position, right? That there's an ethical responsibility, and if we engage in it, we can perhaps overcome the iron cage. The iron cage is it's a regulative claim, right? It's if we continue on this way, this is where we're heading. Whereas I don't think that.
Let me just say, I take this set of comments as an affirmation that there's a real solid problem here. And the problem has got to do with the status of subjectivity, reason, and it's the problem which is laid out by a number of figures, of which Weber is one, and I would take Schmidt to be another, and I would take da-da-da-da-da-da. And it's, you know, it's, from my point of view, that problem is shaped enormously by the experiences of 1880 to 1920. And it feeds into some of the most dramatic experiences of the last century. And Foucault is taking up those questions in a particular way, and that's what makes him important as a thinker. Okay. I think we'd agree on that.
Yeah. Follow up to that. I want to take you up on a promise you made that you didn't fulfill.
How much do I owe you?
You said you were going to talk about his relationship with Searle. And either I missed that or...
You said you were made.
A man.
Same boy.
As I read his early stuff, he and Louis Althusser are struggling with the phenomenologists. I read the phenomenologists and Husserl in particular, as putting the aporia back on the table in the wake of the way in which the Hegelians turned the aporia into a, should we say, a dialectic which is driven by an Aristotelian logic. And so it's always going to be towards the one direction. And the phenomenologists, Husserl especially, try to put the aporetic condition back on the table. They reproduce many of the Kantian moves. They frame it back in relation to Descartes. And you have this whole question of what is the status of geometry, for example. And so to understand where Derrida comes from, and the kind of intellectual background that Foucault is coming from, I think my instinct is, and my reading around this stuff suggests, that we're struggling to understand the problem of the relationship between the phenomena and the world, the status of these categories, like the geometrical categories, which have the status of space and time, and questions of where do these categories come from? And rather than play out the phenomenological, hermeneutical hope that you can actually uncover the depth behind the surface of the phenomena, we've moved to an analysis of where things come from. What is the beginning, what is the process through which we move from one state to another? And it seems to me that, which is sometimes called post-structuralism or structuralism, works in very different ways in many of these thinkers. And I think for Foucault himself, the problem is stated very clearly by Husserl, but in a way which carries the hope that one can nevertheless get back to the underlying depth. And so for Foucault, Husserl represents one extreme, which is intolerable, and Nietzsche is the other extreme. That is to say, Nietzsche is not in the genealogical form, but in the form that says you can never recover the tragic. The tragic has already been destroyed by my modernity. So if I'm between the position that says something is irrecoverable and something which says it's absolutely recoverable, we're trying to find some middle ground, which might mean that Foucault is indeed the Aristotelian. But the middle ground is to be understood not in some abstract categories, but precisely through the institutionalization of particular practices. So he moves through what I understand to be one of the mainstreams of neo-Kantianism in the 1880s, 1890s, trying to think through the sociological a priori, the processes through which not not ideology is formed, the line that goes down to sociology of knowledge, but precisely to the institutions through which the origin are removed, works out as a normal, exceptional production of the same. And so it's the sovereignty move, the foundational move. The paradox for me is that in the end, Foucault does not engage that sovereignty practice of origins, and he obsesses with Kant's notion of the juridical sovereign. He tries to cut off that head, but he doesn't bother with the source. And I think that it's Husserl from whom he gets it in the beginning, his very early years. I'm an amateur on this stuff, so I'm just...
Okay, so, great paper.
Notes.
Notes, okay. I want to go back to one thing you said. You said maybe what I'm talking about is in the analytic of finitude. For the students here, there's a part at the very end of the order of things that Rob's referring to here, which is really important. And Foucault lays out what he calls the three doubles of modern thought that sort of emerged late 18th, early 19th century. And these three doubles are precisely the dualities that Rob's reminding us to think about and the oscillation between them. And Foucault makes this very strong claim that all schools of modern thought oscillate back and forth within one of these three doubles. One is the transcendental empirical, under which he places all of the modern social sciences. The second is the phenomenological double of the cogito and its background unthought and the oscillation between those. And the third is the hermeneutic, the something in the retreat to the origins, as he's Pentes. So that's Kant, Merleau-Ponty or Husserl, and thirdly Heidegger in the hermeneutical tradition. And what struck me about the talk was you were saying, look, all these moderns, in fact, are in these three doubles that you described, and they oscillate back and forth like this. It seemed to me, in a way, an affirmation or an exploration of the three doubles, as he put in the order of things. So if that's true, then my question is, there's one thing Foucault thought he had achieved by that description at the end of the order of things, namely that the order of things was not within these three doubles, but it was actually an attempt to describe them, to somehow get a reflexive distance from them. And he made two claims about that. One, he said, was they're not, the doubles themselves aren't meta-transcendental, so to speak. They emerged sometime late 18th century by this odd change from the classical age to the modern age, as he calls it. So it's possible to think otherwise, historically at least, than these doubles that we all, in virtue of being moderns, think within and oscillate between. The second thing you want to say at the end is, well then, what about now? Can we think otherwise? And he says, modern thoughts, even the attempts to get out of them, end up moving within them. And he kind of, well maybe you have a different reading at the end of the book, but he doesn't say he's thinking otherwise, but he's just saying it's a possibility that humans at some time, after the death of man and so on, all these doubles, could think otherwise. Not that they could will this change into being themselves, but that nonetheless, this whole oscillation that you're talking about are the oscillations of modern thought. And I'm just wondering if we're reading Foucault the same way, or are you saying something a little more about it?
I accept that reading completely, actually. And I accept the reading of, I think when the term Stoic was used, there's a Stoic attitude, which I take it he's deploying against a grandiose attitude, the attempt to pretend that we can break through. He's very clear that once you're into this modern, into the doubles, the reciprocity, the limits, then the temptation is to move beyond. but the very temptation to move beyond is going to keep you in the doubles. And, well, that's not an original thought to him, that's through lots and lots of thinkers. And I think that's very clearly expressed in the Analytic of Finitude. I think it's an absolutely brilliant text. Well, that part of the text is brilliant. And I think that haunts him all the way through the rest of his work, actually. And I actually don't. You know, I have two attitudes. One, I would say he doesn't move beyond that. And the other would be to say, well, surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to move beyond that, because that is precisely the modern condition. And it's a brilliant diagnosis. And that's why, you know, I'm always fixated on that text. I more or less stop with the order of things until I jump to his engagement with Schmidt and company, and because of my interest in the theory of the state. But I think the order of things depiction of that problem is so profound and forces us back into the Kantian articulation of the problem. And my own conclusion is, if you accept that articulation of the problem, you're going to get stuck in it. So I would say, actually, you've got to refuse the originary mode. I would actually accept Derrida's critique, and even more so. Althusser's critique that in the end, Foucault does not deal with the originally founding problem. He's therefore always going to end up with a limit problem, because the limit problem occurs at the moment of founding, before and after, and that transposes itself to the two limits. So I think the historical problem is actually in drawing the line between the before and the after, which is precisely what's troubling him in his early work. So although I'm quite happy to admit that I'm imposing my question onto Foucault, like the rest of us, but I think that's an important question, and it's one that needs to be got at in order to deal with the more obvious questions about the way in which he deals with the limits of subjectivity, or the limits of the state, or the society must be defended, or we must move beyond it. So it's the founding problem, but for me it's a limit problem.
But you don't see the founding problem, the origin problem, as one of the doubles, as the third one.
It's described as one of the doubles, but it's also the one that he's working through for himself most clearly. It's another of the versions. If you wish to escape this, don't start from here. But I don't. I mean, it speaks to my last conclusion. I mean, he is a nationalist, like it or not, like the rest of us. All of us, we're all nationalists, because we're all playing within a particular understanding of the state in the end. It's absolutely striking that Foucault, I mean, name any of the fancy theorists, and the implicit understanding of a society, the understanding of humanity, is actually a status understanding. And for someone, and the complaint is as accurate for Habermas as it is for Foucault, and as it is for Derrida, as it is for whatever, the move is from the state to the cosmopolitan, the international, i.e. the field in which there is already a given array of pluralities which enable the particular universality to allow the particularities of subjectivity to work out within the state, i.e. the problem of subjectivity being dependent upon a range of other subjectivities, not least the subjectivity of modernity as something distinct from something else. That originary moment is sometimes present, but for the most part, it's absent. And I think that, as we say, the limits of the modern, as they're spread out in the international, are related to the limits of the founding of the modern, which gives rise to the doubles that Foucault analyzes so brilliantly.
Well, I see you doing what Foucault didn't do, namely looking at international relations theory, but finding there the same doubles, like you say.
Triples. They have to be triples. And the doubles work out exactly the same way in the international. And there's always an outside to the double. There's always a constitutive outside. And the outside of the international, of course, is also a temporal one. It's framed as the development into modernity. And that's the way that Kant spins out, coming from the outside in. So I mean, Kant is present on both of these dimensions, the founding moment and the limit moment. And I think Foucault does as brilliant a job as can be done, actually, just working through those things within the relation of the state. But I think it's only part of the job.
Anyone else?
I'm told when you're monitoring, you're supposed to have a backup question for these types of moments when no one has a question. So I'll spring my hook and just grab my hand. It's a bit of a practical question. I was wondering if you could speak to Foucault as an academic practice. We're always told that, you know, he went to the prisons, he went to the bathhouses. Now, ironically, for anyone who seeks to evoke that biography, usually not at the prison or the bathhouse, but they're in an academic environment. And they're not really sort of reaching out in that same sort of way. I mean, we know that for most of us attending this conference, we have some familiarity with Foucault. We've at least heard of Foucault. There are plenty of people out there in prisons and bathhouses who have no idea who this person is. So I was just wondering if you could speak to sort of his practice and sort of treading the line between activism, academics, and how that is sort of expressed within the text but then carried out through a practice, and how that maybe relates to this critical ethos that he discusses in What is Enlightenment and What Have
You. Part of me wants to resist the question, because you make a distinction between the academy and the world. So you go out and do practice, and therefore you downgrade the practice that occurs in here, which is part of the world. And there's a kind of heroization of the non-academic world, which is part of the sort of insecurity complex, of the inferiority complex of academics have. Academics are actually kind of important. Their legitimation strategies are in extraordinary order. They do all kinds of damage and all kinds of good. And that damage occurs not just here, with you lot, but out in the world. So, you know, Kissinger's absolutely dead wrong. The stakes are very high. That's one part of the analysis. And there are different ways of playing that through. We all actually have a presence in the world. Whether one plays it out in some concrete, visible, televisual field or not. So, does that response provoke a different sort of question?
Yeah, the question was merely provocative
in itself. So. Is there anyone else who would like to jump in? If not, I think there's some coffee and snacks remaining where we can finish off some of these conversations. But before we do so, I'd like to thank our four main theorists again, PACTAC, UPS, and UPS.